Hello and welcome back to the ASI podcast. Today we'll be talking about the space economy, and we're delighted to be joined by Professor Joe Little, digital entrepreneur in residence at the University of Stirling. He's an affiliate of the Institute for the Future and Association of Professional Futurists, following a 35-year career in oil and gas and the BAE space sector. Joe, thanks for coming on.
No, delighted to be on. Thanks for inviting me, Sean.
Excellent. So Joe, if you could just tell us a bit more about your role, what you do.
Yeah, so it's probably worth explaining what a futurist is. I don't actually sit with a crystal ball every day predicting the future as my family would have everyone think of it. What I try and do is actually, and what futurists try and do is try and help organizations, people sort of understand all the possible futures that could be in the next 10 years or so, looking at signals we see right now and evidence right now, and trying to build in a perspective on where things could be. Space in particular being a really interesting one. So I genuinely believe that we're going to have the most interesting 10 years in space that there has ever been coming up, from a number of different angles and a number of different perspectives as to how it could go. So the perfect time to start to look at space and where it could actually go.
Absolutely. So what makes these next 10 years so crucial?
I think the biggest change really has been on increasingly more private investment. So the barriers to entry into space have decreased rapidly. And what you find naturally when you have private and public sector coming together like this is really sort of significant de-risking of activity, more democratized sort of apportioning of contracts. As a result, both kind of fuel each other. So hence you have, you know, a space economy now that didn't exist really 10, 15 years ago. It was kind of focused on a few companies and really a few contracts with very limited possibilities and a lot of risk management going as part of that.
Excellent. So zooming out for people who might not know, what exactly is the space economy?
So the space economy, if you look at it from point of view, is actually either, you know, investing in companies who are building, you know, launch vehicles, building an infrastructure, or then using space both as its manufacturing destination, its destination for exploration or for habitation, or actually then going back and observing Earth. So observation of environmental or security or a number of different issues that we have on the planet, or enabling possibilities of businesses through the use of satellites and satellite technology. So that's just the beginning of it. There's so many more areas that then come as part of it as we begin to build out that infrastructure in terms of security and defense, etc.
Absolutely. So those of us who follow the sector have heard people like Jeff Bezos talk about manufacturing in space, sure. And we've all heard that Elon Musk wants to move to Mars. But how realistic are both of these aspirations, and what might be coming in the next 5 to 10 years? Will we be having lunar factories by 2030, or not really?
So if you take a very, and I always feel that you have to look at this in terms of Jim Data's framework. So there could be growth, there could be decline or constraint, depending on a number of different scenarios. If you take a growth scenario, yes, we are going to be launching a lot more rockets, building infrastructure in space. So that infrastructure is largely going to be targeted on obviously commercial ventures in a number of different areas. The moon, you mentioned that we're going to be building sort of lunar factories. What I think we're going to see more of in the next 5 years is building the infrastructure in order to make that happen. Mm. So creating more sustainable vehicles, which can launch into space and then, you know, transport materials into where they need to be. I think you're going to start to see construction of cislunar gateways. So cislunar gateways are basically a point in space at which the gravitational pull from the Earth and the Moon is neutralized to a degree. So therefore, ideal point at which to build a kind of a space station that can help you land on the Moon more effectively and more safely. So you'll begin to see that build out. And there's already, you know, a charge towards crowding those spaces. There aren't many of them. And there's only really two which are actually viable. So starting to see a lot more of that. And of course, the people who are actually building them. So a lot more people moving into space who aren't the billionaires going on a joyride. A lot more people are going to be out there really building this stuff. What we're going to be doing on the moon is really around, again, exploration, looking for minerals, looking for water, looking for regolith to turn into helium-3. If we can do that and we can extract helium-3 more effectively, then we can use that as a launch pad to the Mars and beyond going into the next decade. So an exciting time in that respect.
Helium-3 is used for fusion technology.
It is, yeah. So basically need that to effectively launch more reasonably to Mars. And I think if you're looking at sort of the view in getting to Mars, I mean, we've discussed this ourselves. I think there's kind of two views. One is sort of charging there as quickly as possible and taking as much risk in order to be the first. I think there's a more reasonable sort of view that we've used the moon and activities there as the perfect sort of de-risked dress rehearsal for missions beyond the moon to Mars, particularly if we're looking at sustainability of those trips. So I think you'll see some different schools of thought. I think sometimes, you know, leaning towards the pioneering spirit of getting there first may drive some activity, but I think the de-risking sounds like a better option there. But that's the upside. I mean, the other side is that we are building up so much activity in low Earth orbit with satellites that whilst it's really interesting, it's building up possibilities. It also, you know, presents considerable risk as well. So it really only takes one missile or one or two missiles in low Earth orbit to produce a kind of chain reaction, a Kessler effect syndrome, it's called, at which we could render a low Earth orbit completely impenetrable for some time. So you have to take the view that if that happens, then we are going to shut down space for a while. So really, you've got to look at companies like Astroscale, who do space cleanup. I love the analogy that their founder actually has is, you know, we are kind of going into space. If you imagine if you were building highways, that we used to build them, as to analogous to what we're doing in space, you know, you would be sort of running out of fuel and then just abandoning your car. You know, that's what we've been doing in space as an analogy for some decades now. So we need to do a fair bit of cleanup. We need to do a fair bit of you know, situational management, because a lot of what's in space is not identified or owned. And there's a lot of nefarious activity going on. So there's a recent conference I attended. They basically stated there's a fivefold year-on-year increase in nefarious activity in space. You know, nation states or bad actors moving satellites into areas where other satellites would want to be, or even interfering with other satellites in space as well, or listening in. So there's a lot going on in that respect that you can't really avoid. So there's a reason why there's a space force, and you will see a growth in that particular activity as well, as the kind of the threat of shutdown, the threat of possibilities sort of increases as well.
Excellent. And we've seen a number of incidents in the past two years with Elon Musk's Starlink satellites coming dangerously close to government sites. I know he's almost hit the ISS and the Chinese Tiangong. So what do you think is the solution to this? Is it better communication between public and private sector? Should there be some sort of global equivalent to air traffic control for space? How do we prevent accidents like this from happening?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So air traffic control level of situational awareness and capability is where we need to get to. We wouldn't have started at this point, really. It is that messy, but we need to get to that point, which we are fully understand what's going where and the potential collisions, and can therefore warn the right people and know who the right people are in order to avoid that happening. So there's a lot of opportunities there, a lot of opportunities for investment in developing that technology and making it much more effective. I mean, there's a headline even this week. So I monitor signals of potentially where things are. There was a headline this week where the FAA actually is warning people that we are going to go through a decade where falling satellites are going to be happening more often, and they're going to start killing people. So just prepare yourself. That's going to be more of a headline going forward. That's the sort of level of activity we've got now in space. But it doesn't seem to be slowing down the launches. So I think the last count that I went through, there are 36 spaceports being planned or in action. There's going to be 66 by the end of the decade. That's a lot of spaceports, a lot of launching going on, and it's growing exponentially.
Where are these spaceports being built?
Globally, right across the globe. So it's no longer the three or four nations that have been launching thus far. So considerable amount in South America and Africa and Asia in particular. As we know, Scotland, I think there are four spaceports being planned in Scotland. So lots of opportunities there for building a space industry and a space infrastructure around that.
And we'd love to see that. Zooming back into Asia, when you say about the Asian space race, is this India and China, or is there room for smaller actors as well?
There's room for smaller actors as well. So, I mean, there are 55 space agencies, national space agencies around the globe. Obviously, some of them are absolutely tiny, but you know, all those nations have ambitions to have a space business, either in partnership with others or to have their own capability. And I think taking in part, we sort of looked at, you know, what's been going on with China and with India in particular. I mean, China's investment in space has really grown exponentially. I mean, they've always been in space. I mean, the first Long March rocket was way back in way back in 1970. And some people probably don't realize it, but in the latter 80s, the entire planet only had two launch mechanisms, one out of Russia and one out of China. That for a period of time was all we had for launching satellites. So they've been in the space race for quite some time. Their interest has grown dramatically, though, and their confidence around their own space program, largely isolated, to get basically the Tiangong space station up and running for themselves, and then on to the Moon and Mars later on after that, is you know, growing exponentially. Why they're now seeing, you know, the opportunities there for financial gain, and the opportunities there for China to be the premier nation in space.
Okay, and comparing and contrasting to the Indian space program, because China's is, you know, it's a prestige space program. They've had two space stations, they've put men in orbit, they've put women in orbit, they've done spacewalks. India has not yet sent a human into space, aside from one citizen who went in the 80s with the Soviets. And they seem to have really lent into a much cheaper, much more robotic version of space travel, you know, emphasis on probes. Yeah. And, you know, it seems to be achieving remarkable results, is that their recent moon mission cost a third of what it cost to repair Hammersmith Bridge. So, you know, what do you...
Or half the movie of half the cost of Interstellar, the movie.
Exactly. Yeah. So how would you compare the Indian and Chinese space programs? Or generally speaking about, is the future of space travel going to be, as Martin Rees has said, much more, you know, robotic, much more probe focused, or is it still humans?
So I think there's largely the mistake of the 1960s was getting humans into space and their obsession with that. There's a reality about space. I mean, even those who are hugely enthusiastic about space travel get very realistic around human beings just aren't built for space. We're not supposed to be there. The threat to life is significantly higher than on our planet, even in the worst of terrains. So in terms of exploration, in terms of infrastructure, etc., you have to lean towards more robotic solutions. The cost of human beings adds significantly, 5-10-fold onto a mission, no matter where you go. The risks are so high, and you have to feed them, and you have to keep them safe from radiation, and they have to, you know, be in space for a short period of time. Otherwise, the body begins to degrade significantly. Humans are actually the problem in space. There are now significant studies, I think about 20 odd studies, into different areas of which human beings begin to become a problem in space, alongside all these other programs. Where the Indians are getting it right, absolutely right, is that focus on probes and robotics. I honestly believe we'll start to move to a phase at which we get that. We understand that we've got to send robots and probes and infrastructure well in advance of human beings going anywhere. And for us to really understand those environments before we can consider moving a human being to it. So expect that whole economy there to go dramatically. It always has been an interesting area. And now with the possibilities of moving to Mars and to mining and beyond that, you can look at much more capability being built and developed. What's great about India is they've proved something. They've proved that you don't have to have multi-billion dollar programs in order to do really good things there. And I think as a result, as a sort of, you know, a flagship, as it were, to private industry, demonstrated that that can be done.
Excellent. So you could say that the Indians have really taken sort of Elon Musk approach of bringing the price point down massively.
It is, yeah. It's what Elon Musk has been perfect in doing is that, you know, showing that private industry can produce a more sustainable, low-cost program. And the Indians have gone to the next level on that as well. So again, just making space that much more affordable for people who want to do business there.
Excellent. And so what is it in particular that makes it worth going to get resources in space? So we mentioned that helium-3 barely exists on Earth, and yet, you know, it's abundant in lunar regolith. But is it valuable enough to justify going all the way to the moon to get it? You know, at what point? We hear a lot about the space economy, but no one stops to ask, is how expensive is it going to be? Are you going to be able to turn a profit, you know, extracting lunar resources?
Yeah, so I had a look at the site example, which was launched this week. I mean, that's estimated to be a $10 quadrillion metal-rich asteroid.
Right.
The site's heading, you know, heading to the site, about the site mission's heading to the site. So that's mind-blowing numbers. So why don't you try and see what's feasible there?
Absolutely. Well, I suspect that's more money than's currently in circulation on Earth. So definitely mind that. So moving on, you know, as a futurist, moving on, you know, beyond the sort of 2030, 2035 period, what comes after a return to the moon and perhaps moves to Mars? You know, could we perhaps mine things in the asteroid belt? Is there a physical limit to human expansion in the solar system?
There is a physical limit to human expansion, as it were. I think if you're looking in that sort of time frame, realistically, we're going to establish ourselves more on the moon, and the benefits to going elsewhere will start to roll out in the next 20, 30, 40 years after that. Mars is tough, really, really tough to get to. If you're talking about human beings going there, that's a highly risky journey. If you're talking about establishing a base there or a community there, that's even more expensive to do and keeping people safe. I mean, we haven't cracked yet. You know, one of the, you know, the big questions is, you know, how do human beings survive the next generation in space? You know, the risk is too high for radiation and from radiation levels right now to even think about that. So we have a lot of problems to solve there as human beings before we can start to go beyond. But what I do see is a lot more exploration, both of Mars and of the asteroid belt, for possibilities of building infrastructure there. So perhaps by the end of this century, you are at a point at which we're beginning to build infrastructure that goes beyond Mars and out to the asteroid belt.
Excellent. Well, how realistic do you think it is that we, you know, the Americans have said that they could get to the moon by, well, they were promising 2024 and now they're saying 2030-ish. How realistic do you think it is to have someone on the moon from any country by 2030, considering that no human has left low Earth orbit in nearly 50 years?
So basically you have a nice little race going on now. So that always encourages the situation. I think we have a sensible sort of stage at the moment at which, you know, launching a human being into space is highly risky. So there's a lot of attention placed on the programs that are doing that. Taking them to the moon, I think, is being rehearsed in a fairly reasonable manner, but increasingly people will become impatient and wish to do a lot more there. I personally feel that this staged approach of building infrastructure and building capability to the moon is a much more sensible approach. We will start to see those colonies being built on the moon. I actually think within this decade, you will start to see that. And we'll start to see, at any point in time, a population of hundreds in the space, both in space and on the moon. By the end of this day. So it's going to be much more commonplace and we will get beyond those issues. The reality in all of that is, I mentioned the previous problem with escaping low Earth orbit, but also, we still have a lot of focus on those initial missions and the success of those initial missions, and that can set back a program considerably should they not go, or should they not actually actively get going. If I was an investor in this area, I think there's a lot to be done in low Earth orbit, a lot more businesses that can be built there. There are a lot more infrastructural businesses which are currently startups, some of which are actually beginning to deploy, but there's a lot of focus as well that I would invest in too. As for human exploration, that's always going to be risky. So I would be investing in companies who actually try and de-risk that. Trying to help human beings survive space more effectively, building them habitats and building them capability there, and then looking beyond that to 2 or 3 decades on, as to what we do in terms of mining and energy.
Excellent. So, are there any opportunities for Scottish investors and Scottish business? We've mentioned the 4 spaceports that are being built, but are there any sort of startups in Scotland that you're aware of that are working in the space economy?
In Scotland, the strategy seems to be on kind of twofold. One on building the spaceports themselves to get that capability, and the other seems to be much more focused on the downstream analytics coming from satellites and coming from low Earth orbit. So you can see there's a whole gap there of possibilities in terms of creating a space industry that helps with the infrastructure of building satellites, building rockets and building satellites, which we can actually sort of move into. Also, there's an immense amount of experience of working in remote areas. We've had an offshore industry in Scotland now for 60 years. A lot of knowledge that can transfer into the space industry there as to how to effectively live and work more effectively in remote situations. So a lot of possibilities we can transfer that knowledge into the space industry and begin to build out that infrastructure and that capability in space. If you've got a spaceport on your doorstep, why aren't you building more capability around it? It doesn't make sense to me to ship all that stuff in. It makes sense to build it as close as possible to where you're going to launch it.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's all we've really got time for today. Yeah. But thank you so much for joining us, Joe. It's been absolutely fascinating.
It's been a pleasure.
So in closing, what would you say are the most important themes in the new space economy, the most important areas and trends to watch in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I continue to look at, where's the investment going? It's always where the money's going in all of this. Have a look at, some of the reports which have come out from the one I helped in Deloitte and others, which really sort of highlight where the investment's going. And it is going into so many different areas. I think about 19 different areas in terms of space, food production, nuclear energy, space solar, in space servicing, assembly and repair. There's so many possibilities of which to look at. What I would say though is look at those missions, particularly focused on building out infrastructure, and how they're evolving, because a lot more interesting things can happen there by way of that activity. And I think that's where things are going to be interesting and exciting. Also, I keep a close eye on how, quickly nations are planning to head to the moon. We have currently no laws in space which are fully signed up to. The Artemis Accords are the best attempt. Only at last count, I think it was 28 nations have signed up to that. China, Germany, and Russia haven't signed up three nations, which are fairly significant there. So we kind of have a bit of a Wild West going on right now. So I think whilst that continues to be the situation, you're going to see a lot more interesting and unexpected activity.
Well, absolutely. It sounds equally exciting and slightly frightening, the future of space. Well, anyway, Professor Joe Little, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.